Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
I'm Dori Scheimer, filling in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpot, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings a unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hi, Jack. It's great to be with you.
Hello, Dori.
It is episode 30. What's the headline this week?
The Haunting Relevance of D-Day.
Jack, tell us more about that.
We're approaching the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and we're going to run today excerpts from President Reagan's speech at Normandy on the 40th anniversary in 1984. We're doing that because President Reagan outlines in a way that is sort of unforgettable what collective security means, what the Atlantic Alliance means, the importance of allies, and how America can't go it alone in the world, as the MAGA Republicans seem to want to do. So we're going to hear from Ronald Reagan.
Okay, Jack, normally we keep clips to about 30 seconds when we play them on air. But today we are going to play some much longer excerpts of that speech to really honor what Ronald Reagan said on that day. So stick with us. We're going to hear about 3 minutes from Ronald Reagan.
We're here to mark that day in history when the Allied armies joined in battle to reclaim this continent to liberty. For 4 long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon. At dawn, on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion, to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers at the edge of the cliffs shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades, and the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. And behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war. Gentlemen, I look at you and I think of the words of Stephen Spender's poem. You were men who in your, quote, lives fought for life and left the vivid air signed with your honor. I think I know what you may be thinking right now. Thinking we were just part of a bigger effort. Everyone was brave that day. Well, everyone was.
That was President Ronald Reagan at a ceremony commemorating the 40th anniversary of D-Day in June of 1984. Jack, what do you think is so significant about what we just heard from President Reagan?
Well, first of all, I have to say, and it takes nothing away from the valor of these men, that when they got to the top of those cliffs, the guns that were supposed to be there, that it was their mission to remove, the guns were gone. All the bloodshed, all the suffering had been for nothing. It's a face of war absurdity. The Germans had moved the guns that were supposed to be there, and the men had climbed the cliffs, and many had died in a fruitless mission lit up by their courage. So it was a moment of an infinity of such moments in that war. And I should say, why were those men climbing the cliff? Because they had no place on the continent. After the Great War, after World War I, we left Europe. And all the rise of the dictatorships, Munich, you know, the fall of France, all of that was in a continent that America had no connection with. Isolationism ruled here. And if Donald Trump has his way, if he's elected, his aide, John Bolton, says he means to take us out of NATO. Essentially, he'll restore us to the position of those men. To get back into Europe, we'll have to climb the cliffs, perhaps against a barbarous Russian occupation. Who knows? But we will leave Europe to its own devices, and the greatest alliance for peace in history will have been destroyed. So it couldn't be more relevant. That moment signals the failure of isolationism, and the success of the invasion signals the opposite, the strength of collective security and the abiding ties that link us to the liberal democracies of Europe.
And before we get to more on the relevance of today and what's going on today that makes Ronald Reagan's words so relevant, let's hear a little bit more from him as he talks about the ideal of democracy.
Today, as 40 years ago, our armies are here for only one purpose: to protect and defend democracy. The only territories we hold are memorials like this one and graveyards where our heroes rest. We in America have learned bitter lessons from two world wars. It is better to be here ready to protect the peace than to take blind shelter across the sea, rushing to respond only after freedom is lost. We've learned that isolationism never was and never will be an acceptable response to tyrannical governments with an expansionist intent. But we try always to be prepared for peace, prepared to deter aggression, prepared to negotiate the reduction of arms, and yes, prepared to reach out again in the spirit of reconciliation. In truth, there is no reconciliation we would welcome more than a reconciliation with the Soviet Union, so together we can lessen the risk of war now and forever. It's fitting to remember here the great losses also suffered by the Russian people during World War II. 20 million perished, a terrible price that testifies to all the world the necessity of ending war. I tell you from my heart that we in the United States do not want war. We want to wipe from the face of the earth the terrible weapons that man now has in his hands. And I tell you, we are ready to seize that beachhead. We look for some sign from the Soviet Union that they are willing to move forward, that they share our desire and love for peace, and that they will give up the ways of conquest. There must be a changing there that will allow us to turn our hope into action. We will pray forever that someday that changing will come. But for now, particularly today, it is good and fitting to renew our commitment to each other, to our freedom, and to the alliance that protects it. We're bound today by what bound us 40 years ago, the same loyalties, traditions, and beliefs. We're bound by reality. The strength of America's allies is vital to the United States, and the American security guarantee is essential to the continued freedom of Europe's democracies. We were with you then. We're with you now. Your hopes are our hopes, and your destiny is our destiny. Here in this place, where the West held together, let us make a vow to our dead. Let us show them by our actions that we understand what they died for. Let our actions say to them the words for which Matthew Ridgway listened, "I will not fail thee nor forsake thee." Strengthened by their courage, heartened by their value, and borne by their memory, let us continue to stand for the ideals for which they lived and died. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Jack, I'm going to repeat a line that President Reagan said midway through that chunk we just played for you. "We've learned that isolationism never was and never will be an acceptable response to tyrannical governments with an expansionist intent." Jack, do you think the U.S. has forgotten that lesson?
Well, a good part of the Republican Party has, not all of it. And I think I hope we will find that out when a good many Republicans vote. And I hope they will vote for aid to Ukraine. But within the Trumpian wing of the party, yes, that spirit rules. Trump has said just recently, he said, "If you don't pay up your dues to NATO, to the NATO countries, I'll say to the Russians, go ahead, take over those countries. We don't care." He has gone out of his way to disparage NATO. And he's not alone. Here we have J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, saying, talking to Steve Bannon, "I don't really care what happens to Ukraine." Pat Buchanan, the paleo conservative, hailing Putin for, quote, "standing against the cultural imperialism of the decadent West." Putin standing for, quote, "Christian values." In the New York Times, of all places, a writer, Christopher Caldwell, says Vladimir Putin is not the president of a feminist NGO. He is not a transgender rights activist. He is the preeminent statesman of our time. This is almost rampant ignorance, willful ignorance, and it flies in the face of our historical experience after the First War and the lesson we drew for it after the second, which was there is only peace in collective security. And Trump would pull that rug out from under really the long peace since the Second World War, a long peace broken by Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
At the end of the speech, Reagan says repeatedly, "Let us show them by our actions." Well, the actions that you just referred to is the House of Representatives this week is reportedly trying to come up with some aid bills, both for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan. What are you taking from the possible action and actually how hard it is for the House of Representatives to get to action? I mean, there are Republicans who are seemingly more likely to work to push House Speaker Mike Johnson out of that position than they are to take votes this week on those foreign aid packages.
Yes, it's really splitting his party. But if he were to put the Ukraine bill on the floor, it would pass overwhelmingly. All the Democrats would vote for it, and a good number of Republicans would. He just can't. He's between a rock and Marjorie Taylor Greene, really. You know, she now joined by another ultra have said, if you put Ukraine on the floor, we'll vote to take you down as Speaker, which we did just a few months ago to Kevin McCarthy. So we'll, I think Mr. Johnson is going to find his courage. I hope so. And the Democrats say that if it comes to that, his speakership on the line, some of them, will vote for him, and he will be able to hold on to that office. On the other hand, that will cast a shadow over everything he does with his own party subsequently. So he's in an almost impossible dilemma.
We did a show about the U.S.'s approach and potentially changing foreign policy with Israel about a week or so ago. And we talked about how Ukraine had a much more dire need for weapons and support right now in their fight against Russia. And in an interview with PBS NewsHour this week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said it's very difficult to fight Russia, as we talked about, given the size of Russia's army and the scope of their supplies. And I mean, he said the outlook is bleak without additional U.S. support.
I can tell you frankly, without this support, we'll have no chance of winning. You need to be much stronger than your enemy. Today, our artillery shell ratio is 1 to 10. Can we hold our ground? No. In any case, with these statistics, they'll be pushing us back every day. To defend 100% of what's in our control, we would need to go from 1 to comparing numbers.
10 to 10.
The plan is very simple. It's very clear. It exists. There is a specific weapon that we need to advance. There's a specific weapon to defend the skies. This plan exists. Besides, all the partners have it in their hands. This is the plan for what we really need.
That was Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in an interview with PBS NewsHour this week. Jack, what do you think?
Well, what he's talking about, the lack of ammunition and the lack of defensive missiles even. The BBC reported earlier this week that there was an attack on a Ukrainian power plant. I think the numbers were that 7 missiles or drones, whatever they were, I guess they were missiles. I don't know what they were. But anyway, 7 of them were shot at this place, and they managed with their defensive missiles to shoot down 4 of the 7. But 3 landed and damaged, if not destroyed, the power plant. And they couldn't shoot the other 3 down because they didn't have the defensive missiles. And they didn't have them because, you know, really since August, the Republican House has stopped aid to Ukraine out of kowtowing to Donald Trump's wish to cut Ukraine off, and the result is more death and destruction in Ukraine.
Zelensky went on to say in the interview with PBS NewsHour that Republicans blocking aid to Ukraine is pure politics, and in more pointedly, he called it a, quote, disgrace to democracy.
Well, if the Congress will divide this assistance after everything that happened, will divide into Israeli and Ukrainian, then it means that this is a matter of elections in the United States. It's a matter of pure politics that now when the whole world is saying, how could Iran strike Israel? So now we need to support only Israel and forget what is happening in Ukraine. This is pure politics. Nobody cares how many people are dying in Ukraine every day. They only care about their approval ratings. That's what it's all about. If Ukraine falls and there's a war in other NATO member countries, and there will be a war, and then the U.S. soldiers will be defending and dying. That's what it's going to be. People in Congress need to think twice about pushing these political matters with regards to support of Ukraine and vote to support all of the countries whose lives depend on it.
Jack, do you think that that's what this is? That Congress is just, or at least Republicans in Congress, are just playing politics with support for Ukraine?
Yes. I mean, and it's Trumpian politics. They are afraid of crossing him, and his views on Ukraine are well known. The word he used was disgraceful, and it surely is disgraceful. But, you know, he speaks later in that interview with a kind of bitterness about the way the response to the missile attack, Iranian missile attack on Israel to his own country. He says, you know, your allies shot those missiles down. I think they were French, British, Jordanian, American, all shooting those drones and missiles down that were aimed at Israel. And he said, you know, what about us? We're not getting any allies here shooting the missiles that are coming at us. And why? Well, the reason is Russia is nuclear armed, and that changes everything. Iran, thank God, doesn't have a nuke. And it has sort of been the leitmotif of Biden policy not to provoke any kind of nuclear confrontation with Russia. And that means really slow-walking aid to Ukraine, not giving them everything they need for fear that that will push Putin over the edge. It is the nuclear threat. Perhaps indeed it has victimized Ukraine most of all, because we had a Wall Street Journal reporter on our program, Yaroslav Trofimov, who just wrote a book called Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and the Ukrainian War of Independence. And in that interview that Meghna had with him, he said that the offensive that was launched last year by Ukraine, he said the reason it failed was they didn't have the weapons. They didn't have enough to break through the Russian lines. And he said if the Biden administration had delivered X and Y and Z, they might have been able to do it. And of course, the Biden administration didn't send those weapons in time because of the fear of pushing Putin too far, indeed of humiliating him.
Okay, well, Jack, I think we've given them a lot to think about this week. And now I want to hear from you about this idea that Jack has been talking about. So are you concerned that the United States will return to that kind of post-World War I isolationism? Do you think that that would hurt national security here in the U.S. or the global security if the U.S. does not actively engage around the world? So hop on your phones and go to the On Point Vox Pop app. Let us know what you think. If you don't already have it, search On Point Vox Pop in the App Store. So when I'm not here filling in for Meghna, I'm the one who listens to every single message that we get. And I'd love to listen to lots of messages on this week's topic. So we're going to take a quick break before we hear your thoughts about last week's episode. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
All right. Last week, we asked if you think that the Justice Department is politically compromised and whether you trust prosecutions involving political figures are being conducted in good faith. And if you don't think so, do you have any alternative plans of how the Justice Department could be more independent? And we heard from lots of you. So we're going to start with Tom Good. He called us from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and he says that at least during the Biden administration, he's confident in the independence of the Justice Department.
Recall the extreme caution, reluctance to the point of procrastination that it took for Attorney General Garland to finally indict Trump on the documents in January 6th cases, knowing that delay could prove fatal to any case if Trump wins in November. Let's notice that the only provable crimes against a Biden family member, Hunter, are being today aggressively prosecuted by his dad's Justice Department.
Jack, what do you think about Tom's point here?
He's right on. I mean, the Times had a big piece a couple of weeks ago about just this, about how Garland wanting to, look at his situation. He's coming in after William Barr, who was the most blatantly political attorney general probably since John Mitchell under Nixon. And Garland's charge was to restore morale in the Justice Department, which had gone to hell under Trump, and to keep his hands off anything that looked like a political prosecution. And so it was really the case that the January 6th committee prodded the Justice Department into action. It seems they were reluctant to act. But Tom is absolutely right. And yes, Hunter Biden is facing serious charges that could get him years in prison. Wouldn't that, it would be awful for him and the Bidens, but what a sign of the Attorney General's independence. And I would also say, look at the anger at the from the Biden White House at the report of Robert Hur, the special counsel who was looking into President Biden's use of documents. He took documents home with him and so on. He cleared him of any issue there, but he went out of his way, really in a kind of gratuitous way, to talk about Biden's memory and his forgetfulness. He forgot the date of his son's death. He did a nice old gentleman with a failing memory, something like that, some incredibly condescending statement. The Biden people were furious at Garland for not changing that. But Garland, true to Tom's picture of him, wouldn't do it, you know, because that would be interfering in a prosecution. Even to change this gratuitous and wounding characterization of President Biden.
Chuck, let me just ask you a follow-up on that. I guess, is it worth it for any restored faith in the institutions if President Trump wins again in November and goes back to the kind of Justice Department that was so obviously political in his relationship with Bill Barr? I mean, Hunter Biden may be sitting in jail and everyone says, well, good for the Biden Justice Department, only for all of that faith to be lost again.
Yes, I mean, and not just to say nothing about democracy, because
yeah.
Of course Trump tends to, he really wants to take us into some sort of authoritarian system. No, I mean, yeah, it'll show the purity of Merrick Garland, but at what price virtue? You know, in his defense, that article quoted people, this was the Times reporting on this, saying that it just didn't seem credible to the Justice Department that Trump would be a candidate for president again. It just didn't, you know, after January 6th, and and even as late as December 2022, after all his, you know, after all the palookas that he, you know, the election deniers that he backed in the campaign had really failed, it looked like Trump was, it looked like he had it. But then what happened? In March of 2023, he was indicted in New York on the hush money case that is now being tried. And that got him right back. I think he had a bounce of 12 points, and he's never looked back because Republicans, right from there on, said he's being persecuted politically. This is trumped up. Who cares about a little bookkeeping error? Yes, he hid this. Business with Stormy Daniels. Why? Not to hurt himself in the election, but to hide it from his wife. That's their argument.
Mm. Well, let's hear from Brian Malloy in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Now, he says that, you know, exactly the way that Bill Barr got the job and Merrick Garland got the job, the appointments is what leads to politicization.
Here in Kentucky, we have our attorney general is an elected position, and I'm sure it's probably that way in most other states. Why couldn't we do that on the federal level? We've had plenty of situations here. Matter of fact, we currently do, to where one party was in power as governor and the other party was had the attorney general position. So I think that might certainly help.
Jack, would it help?
Well, it's the case in 34 states and the District of Columbia that attorney generals run for office. And the dynamic in Kentucky seems to hold true. There's one study that looked at not just the U.S., but other presidential systems around the world. And by the way, presidents have been prosecuted in where? France, Germany, Italy. You know, you can go on and on. Israel. presidents have had to face justice in other countries. That isn't unheard of. But this study found that states are more likely to create greater respect for human rights when the justice minister is of a different party than the president. So it seems to be that check and balance seems to work in terms of human rights in other countries around the world. And I think it may well have a cautionary effect on governors and legislators in the U.S. when the party in power is not the Attorney General's party.
Though I assume, Jack, I don't know how this works exactly, but I assume there may be a constitutional amendment involved in changing that at the federal level. So I'm not going to hold my breath if that is something that changes here in the near future.
Yeah, I don't know myself.
Yeah, I don't know. But, it just feels like one of those things that would take quite some time. Okay, let's finish here with Brad Green from Staunton, Virginia. He says, yes, the Justice Department is politically compromised, but so is local law enforcement.
Just want to read a headline from Oregon Public Broadcasting from October 15th, 2020. President Trump boasts of law enforcement who killed Portland protester. Quote, they didn't want to arrest him. Referring to the execution by the U.S. Marshals Service of Michael Reinhold in Washington State, Trump apparently said, we sent in the U.S. Marshals, took 15 minutes, it was over, we got him. So the state and law enforcement are known to be politically right-wing in a lot of cases, judging by the thin blue line, Punisher skull, 3%er, etc., logos that are on even police vehicles. So I think the experience of a lot of people in this country is that law enforcement already has a political tilt.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt people can, there's a lot you can point to substantiate that that point, including that police unions have endorsed Republican presidential candidates for a long time. I remember when Michael Dukakis was running against George Bush, Bush came to East Boston to a rally where the Boston Police Union endorsed him. A slap at Dukakis. This is the political inclinations of, if not individual policemen, then of police unions is clearly to the right. And that may well show up in the policing of demonstrators who are on the left. And by the way, just that moment, doesn't it light up Trump's cruelty that he would be cheering the killing of this person? I mean, there's no bottom to his, there's just no bottom.
Well, Jack, I know that Meghna likes to end on a more hopeful note than politically charged police violence. So let's hope maybe on that note that there is some action and resolution in Congress this week on a foreign aid package.
Wouldn't that be great? And not a moment too soon, because the Russians are pushing hard against the Ukrainian defenses, and they the Ukrainians may well have to retreat and yield territory.
Well, thank you, Jack, as always.
Thank you.
I'm Dori Scheimer. This is the Jack Pod from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear, based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer acute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.